From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Colin Donovan. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
And we welcome you to Open Line Friday here on EWTN, the Global Catholic Radio Network. We are very blessed to be with you on this beautiful Easter Friday afternoon. Jack Williams away today. I am joined by our Friday host, Mr. Colin Donovan. How are you, sir?
Well, pretty good. And like a lot of people here at the network, trying to get through the interregnum, the mourning period, which will begin with the funeral of the Pope tomorrow and ultimately the election of the Pope. So a sad time, but it's certainly an interesting time in the life of the Church.
A fascinating time indeed, and I must relay that on a Monday morning, as all this was very fresh in our minds, some of us had been there since 5 or 6 in the morning. I ran into Colin in the hallway. You may remember this, Colin. And I said, "So, Colin, just another Monday, right?" He goes, "Yeah, I think I'll cruise on the internet for a while and have an extra cup of coffee." And certainly, this has been an unusual week. But you and I have been down this road a couple times.
Well, we have. 2005 with the death of John Paul II, in terms, obviously, of a death. And then we had the resignation of Pope Benedict, which, of course, we had the advance warning of several weeks. Mm-hmm. And so this is actually our second papal death that EWTN has covered in the course of our life since founded in 81 and broadcasting since 82.
Yes, indeed. And you've been very instrumental in keeping us posted on the many changes we've received from the, is it the Congregation of Cardinals?
Well, it's called a General Congregation. We think of the College of Cardinals, but when those who are gathered in Rome meet to address issues of the governance of the Church, there is, especially things like when the funeral will be, that was decided on the first day.
Yeah.
And then on, there'll be decisions coming when the conclave will begin. I think towards the end of the mourning period, which will be all of next week until the Sunday after this Sunday, that decision will come out and we'll know when the election begins. Everything must be done by papal law, because only the Pope has the authority to set the way in which his successor will be elected. So the cardinals are constrained by that law, and they're applying it in the case may be. We've had 4 general congregations, the meeting of the cardinals who are already in Rome, and we're scheduled to have a 5th one on Monday. And then at some point that process will switch to what is called the conclave, which is where the cardinals who are electors, those under 80 who are present in the Sistine Chapel or who are sick and are nearby, and there's a process for dealing with the, you might say, the sick who are local in Rome and in the conclave to that extent. We will move from having congregations of the cardinals to the conclave of the electors, those under 80 who are present in the room, as it were, and actually vote in the succession of votes that will lead to the next pope.
It's all a very fascinating thing, and I think it's very important for people to realize that the Church does not stop. Things are continuing. Yes, it is the death of the Holy Father, but that doesn't mean that the entire Catholic Church is on hold.
No, and it's quite interesting what the law is. Obviously, the dioceses go on as they are, the parishes and the life of the Church, the local churches. The particular churches are local churches, meaning the diocese of the Catholic Church. And those go on. Within the Holy See, of course, authority stops with the death of the Pope. So all of the heads of departments, the prefects and others, They essentially, their office comes to an end. They themselves are no longer the head of that department. And only the ordinary business, you know, just like, you know, if our top management wasn't around, we're still going to go on and do our ordinary things we do every day. We just won't make the big decisions.
Sure.
And so
sure.
They can't make the big papal decisions, if you will, but the ordinary paper shuffling and the things that they do, the decisions making on simpler things, that will all go on. Now, in addition to these general congregations that I've described where all the cardinals come together, there are what's called the particular congregations. These are a very small number of bishops who in the law are to be chosen to assist the Camerlingo and in the running of the church. And the senior bishop, the dean of the college, Cardinal Ray. And so they're sort of doing the active running of this, you know, we're here, but we're not doing the big stuff.
Sure, sure.
And so that daily stuff will go on under their management until the new pope is elected. And then the governance of the church will essentially get reset up again because people will be either temporarily reappointed to the positions they held under Pope Francis or other things will be determined. So it's all sort of nitpicky when you think about it as an outsider, but at the same time, it's all very well thought out, and it's a practice procedure.
Yeah.
The church has been doing this more or less, the use of the cardinals and the cardinal electors in this way it is done today since the 11th century.
Okay.
1000s. And so before that, at different times in history, the popes were chosen in different ways. In the early church, it was the clergy of Rome and the surrounding sees, and that we see that structure still represented in the titles given to cardinals. You have the cardinal bishops whose title is a suburban see or subucarian see, as it's called in Latin. You have the cardinal priests who are essentially, quote, honorary parish priests of the Diocese of Rome, and then the cardinal deacons who have sort of administrative responsibilities with. Those are actual positions in the early church, deacons, you know, the surrounding bishops and so on.
Uh-huh.
They would have been the electors. But that process has over time mutated into this electoral college, which we have today and in some variation of it, going back almost 1,000 years. So the popes specify the method, and for about 1,000 years, we've been doing it more or less this way with some variations, pope to pope.
If you've got a question for Colin about the conclave, about the interregnum, about the upcoming funeral mass, we are here for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our little robo response, if you will. And then when you get it, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also shoot us an email if you'd rather do that. openline@ewtn.com. openline@ewtn.com. Lines are open right now if you have a question for Colin. A very interesting question came up last hour with called to communion, Dr. David Anders. Someone mm-hmm. wanted to know why haven't more American cardinals been in the forefront when it comes time to choosing the next pope?
Well, I think we actually have, I don't know if it's the high point, but we have, I think there are maybe 8 or 9 American cardinals.
Uh-huh.
The traditional practice of appointing somebody a cardinal because they occupy a big see, New York, Los Angeles, or Chicago, or some other see,
uh-huh.
that to some extent is true. But the Pope, this present Pope, went out to the peripheries, as he liked to say,
mm-hmm.
and find representatives in places where even there weren't a lot of Catholics, Fiji is one place, East Timor, which an old Portuguese colony, I believe, you know, so and other places as well, that represents his outreach and concern for the poor, the developing world, as opposed to the developed world.
Uh-huh.
So he hasn't followed the old historic practices of a good, you know, probably 100 years at least, and that is of simply appointing men who are the metropolitan archbishops of a significant metropolitan area, like a New York or a Los Angeles,
right,
or a, you know, Paris or some other place. So those particular bishops, I think, still are cardinals, but there are many sees that historically have had cardinals that don't today, because the Pope has chosen to go to the peripheries and to appoint more representative people of the whole church, in a certain sense, you can say, and especially,
yeah,
of the poor and others who are having difficulties in their lives that he has a particular interest in.
Fascinating process. Keep it right here on EWTN Radio and Television. We will keep you up to date. In a moment, we'll talk with Dan in Stillwater, Minnesota. Another Dan, this one on Long Island. Lines are open for you as well at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan here on EWTN.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
Lines are open for you on this beautiful Friday afternoon here on Open Line Friday on EWTN. That number again, 833-288-EWTN. We have two lines open right now. Quick reminder here, the solemn funeral mass for His Holiness Pope Francis is coming up live tomorrow on EWTN Radio and Television, 3 a.m., with an encore for you on both platforms at 10 a.m., and then we'll have another encore on EWTN Television and Radio Extra. That will be at 6 p.m. Eastern. I was going through the memos this morning. The original budget for this was going to be around 4 hours, and I see that has now been expanded to 5 hours because we're going to be covering the procession to St. Mary Major, which is where the burial will actually take place.
That's right. It's called a translation.
Okay.
It means that the body is moved. It's not a word you encounter very often, but there are some saints who will have two feast days. So St. Benedict, who died in March 21st, that's in Lent. So the Pope gave him a feast day in July when you can celebrate more.
Okay.
But having gone to a Benedictine seminary, of course, we celebrated the March 21st date,
of
even
course,
when it was in Lent. But this translation means the movement of the body, that
okay,
his body was moved. In Benedict's case, it was from Nursia to Monte Cassino, where he was entombed there. So in this, St. Benedict, in this case, the Pope has desired to be buried in St. Mary Major's. They've actually released a photograph of this location.
Really?
It's in the chapel of Salus Populi Romano, Salvation of Rome, Our Lady, who is accredited with saving the Rome from plague during the pontificate of Gregory the Great.
I heard that the actual area was between two chapels. Is that right?
Well, it's into the wall on one side of the Salus Populi Romani,
okay,
I believe, unless it means just outside between the two chapels.
Okay.
The next chapel over is, I believe, a Pauline chapel.
Okay.
And so it's going to be there. It's not in the crypt of the Vatican,
mm-hmm,
but there, I think that only like 90 popes altogether are buried in the Vatican. They're scattered all over Rome. Five others, or maybe six others, are in St. Mary's already. I think five, he'll be the sixth. There are some at John Lateran, which is the Cathedral of Rome, and other churches as well. Santa Maria Sopra Minerva, which is one of the early churches built in Rome. The Sopra Minerva is the church knocked down a pagan temple to Minerva and slapped a Marian church on top and said, Take that, Minerva.
I love it.
Yes. Oh, the church was great at this.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Let's get to the phones without further ado here. Here is Dan in one of my favorite small towns, Stillwater, Minnesota, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today, sir?
I'm new to the Catholic Church. I'm a Christian, but I'm learning all about Mass and different nuances. And this week is a special week. They've been calling it Easter all week, and there's a special Sunday coming up. So I'm curious, what's that called, and more details about it.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah. This Sunday has the title of Mercy Sunday, and there's a long history to that. The liturgy of the day is essentially what it has always been. When Father Alar and Johnette and Father John Paul and I did the first live show after the death of the Pope, we talked about this some, and that might be, if you want to go back and see that, Dan, you'll get a little bit more detail on it. But the first Sunday after Easter, the liturgical readings are what happened on the first Sunday after the original Easter. And that is, our Lord appeared in the upper room and said, "Peace be with you, my peace I give you. Whose sins you shall forgive, they are forgiven. Whose sins you shall retain, they are retained." This is the establishment of the sacrament of reconciliation. In other words, Christ, who came to reconcile God and man, the first thing he did to in the church after his resurrection, other than appearing to the disciples on the way to Emmaus, but the first concrete thing he did with the apostles was to give them the instrument of reconciliation of sinners.
Okay.
Now, baptism is the instrument, obviously, for the non-Christian who believes in Christ and through the passion, death, and resurrection is sacramentally received through Christ's passion, death, and resurrection. The sacramental pouring of water representing the death of the sinner and the rising to new life. So baptism does that. But reconciliation is the ongoing repentance of the believer. And so the very first thing he did out of the tomb, other than show the disciples the Eucharistic mystery in a fashion, was to give the church the sacrament of reconciliation. So from the very beginning, this was a sacrament of mercy. Now, that's been the readings. It's had different names through history. When I was a kid, it was called Low Sunday, I guess because it's not quite as high a holy day as Easter Sunday, the Sunday before. It's the second Sunday of Easter. But back in the 1930s, our Lord appeared to a religious sister, Sister Faustina Kowalska, and he wanted the church to institute a Feast of Divine Mercy and also a Novena of Divine Mercy beginning on Good Friday that would last until the second Sunday. And the image of Divine Mercy with water and blood coming out from the side representing, traditionally, this is this in the gospel on the cross, Jesus is said when the was pierced with the lance, blood and water flowed. And that was always interpreted in the early church as baptism and the Eucharist. In other words, representative of the sacramental life of the church, the means by which Christ gives the church to reconcile and give sustenance on a daily basis, as the Eucharist is, it could be for those who go daily, sustenance to the faithful to get them to eternal life. So one of the things she asked was this Feast of Divine Mercy. And so things like that in the church take some time. A mystic receives some insights on the Sacred Heart of Jesus. It took time for the church to accept that particular idea and image and to see how it was previewed and prepared in the teachings of the church, in the tradition. And the Immaculate Heart of Mary as well. And so this is a case where all the elements seem certainly dogmatically correct, but how to get the church, how would the church concretely create this Mercy Sunday? Well, God in his providence, who plans everything even when we don't know he's planning the world behind our backs without our permission, He planned that a Polish pope from Krakow, where Sister Faustina died, would be elected to the papacy out of the dark cloud of communism brought into the West. And, of course, we know the history from there, the overthrowing of the Soviet Union and all that Pope John Paul II did. But one of the things he did in the church was to institute the Feast of Divine Mercy.
To make it official.
To make it official and to give an indulgence on behalf of the papacy, on behalf of the church, to those who do certain practices of devotion to the Divine Mercy on that Sunday. So for many very devout Catholics, Mercy Sunday is a tremendous, not feast day, obviously, because it's still the celebration of Easter, but also because it has this concrete meaning that is represented in the liturgy and has been for ages, but also, you know, focuses their attention on this aspect, praying for groups of souls that need the divine mercy, who are far from Christ or far from the church, if they are Christians, but not Catholics. Or these kinds of things. So these groups of people that Christ wants to take into his side, as it were, to experience the sacramental life he left the church. And so that's the big deal about Sunday, and there are many ways to celebrate it. If you're practicing Catholic, you're going to Mass anyway. Take a few minutes or some time to think about the divine mercy, about the readings of the day and what they mean. To pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy, which is one of the devotions that flowed from the mysticism of Sister Faustina, now Saint Faustina.
All right. Hey, Dan, thanks for checking in from Stillwater, and welcome to the Catholic Church. Hey, that opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986, or if you wish, text the letters EWTN to 58177. All right, we're going to go from Dan to Dan. This Dan is on Long Island, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hello, Dan. What's on your mind today, sir?
Yeah, hi. I understand that two of the major regulations with respect to voting in the conclave is that the cardinals have to be under 80 years old, and there's a maximum of 120 cardinals allowed to vote.
Mm-hmm.
However, I understand now we have about 135 cardinals that are under the age of 80, and I'm just curious how they're going to handle that in the next couple of weeks, whether they'll exceed the number or whether some won't be voting. I'm just curious about that.
Sure. Those who are present are voting. A pope elected all of them and made them electors. So although it's recognized, I don't think anybody canonically is questioning the right of the pope to exceed the 115 or whatever the number was.
Yeah.
So just by the fact that he did it, changed the law, and the next pope can choose to, you know, to observe that number or blow through it if he wants to. And Francis blew through it, and I don't know anyone who questions his right to do that. Remember, there is a general principle even in civil law of the dead hand. He who governs, you know, their authority, you know, once they're gone, the successor has the, you know, has the right, whether it's in civil matters in the civil world or in the church. So the Pope Francis did that, and all of those electors who are present and vote, those votes will be counted. 2/3 of them must elect the new pope, and the election will go on until 2/3 of the voters, of the cardinal electors who are present and voting, do so.
So they're all in the club.
They're all in the club. And I don't know what the reasonings were first by John Paul II, and Benedict didn't change it, and Francis didn't change it either. I think it's set as somewhat of an ideal, so you don't have you know, in inflated, you would want to have 200 cardinals, for example.
Yeah.
I think they'd have to rent rooms across the piazza or something like that.
I think you're right.
Probably.
Yeah.
So there may be some very practical decisions there, but as long as a pope has appointed them, they are electors.
Dan, thanks for your call from Long Island. In a moment, we'll talk with Mary Ann in Cleveland, Henry in San Antonio, Stan in Georgia, Jordan in Cincinnati. Busy phone lines today on Open Line Friday here on EWTN.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, there's still time for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. If you're listening to us in Kansas today, well, your EWTN radio station needs to hear from you next week. The great Divine Mercy Radio will be airing their spring carathon that is going to start on Tuesday. So if you're listening in Hayes, Kansas, or Colby, or Great Bend, or really anywhere, please support your Catholic radio station. All right, back to the phones here at 833-288-EWTN. Marianne listening in Cleveland on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Marianne, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon. My question is it permissible for a Catholic to attend a Jewish Passover Seder dinner?
Okay.
Yeah, this has become popular in recent, recent times, several decades now, I would say. I think it's like going to any particular non-Catholic service. You can do it something as an informational matter, always realizing that if you're a guest in somebody else's church, whether it's a non-Catholic church or a non-Christian church of any kind, that you are not permitted to do sacred things and
right.
take roles which would constitute the practice of that religion, or to embrace anything in any practical sense. In many ways, Judaism is somewhat distinct because it's very easy to say, I've been to, not to a Seder, but I've been to the family meal on Friday evening at dusk when they celebrate the weekly beginning of the Sabbath.
Uh-huh.
And I've been to the Sabbath in the synagogue with a friend who is Jewish, who actually is a rabbi today.
Oh.
Wasn't when I first knew him. He was a fellow naval officer. And so it's quite interesting. You see all the parallels between and all the preparation that God did for the church. And the Seder is certainly one of those. And I remember in liturgy class, trained by Benedictine, so we spent an awful lot of time on liturgy, just ongoing over the course of 4 years, that and sacred music.
Ah.
And so I remember a discussion of how in the Passover Seder, and I think this was coming largely from Father Louis Bouyer, who was a liturgical writer in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, very, very prominent, very influential. And the church was, for the 100 years from the late 1800s into the middle of the 20th century, and today, of course, still, very interested in putting together an understanding and a theology of the liturgy. We have the liturgy as a given. It's been handed down in the church as part of tradition.
Sure.
But there's never been a serious effort really to come up with a theology of the liturgy in any systematic sense.
Hmm.
That's gone on in the last century or so, fostered by the popes and the Second Vatican Council, whatever may think of the results of the reforms there. Nonetheless, that was the purpose, to sort of concretely understand what was taking place in the liturgy so that it could be explained to others and represent understand how it represents the faith of the church to the person participating as well as to the observer.
Hmm.
And so on this particular point, there is a good many arguments on the relationship of two Jewish practices to the Christian practice. One is the Seder, because obviously the Passover connection.
Yeah.
And they keep the cup for Elijah.
Okay.
And what happened to that cup? And we already knew that if you believe it, Elijah has come, our Lord said. But
yes.
the Messiah came as
well. Yes, indeed.
So there are elements of the Seder. And there are elements of the sacrifices in the temple, which one would seem naturally. If Jewish guys were deciding how are we going to fill out this instruction of our Lord on the Last Supper,
uh-huh.
Do this in remembrance of me. They know, the context is certainly a Seder.
Sure.
But give us this day our daily bread. We probably ought to be doing this more often than, you know, on the Sabbath, which became the day of the resurrection as uh-huh. opposed to the day of creation,
mm-hmm.
Sunday. And so trying to understand that, the other things that the church does today, you look at the antecedents in Judaism. You had the sacrifices morning and evening. Well, the Mass can be offered at any time, everywhere. And Malachi predicted as much, from the rising of the sun to its setting, a perfect offering. The only perfect offering is the offering of the Son of God, Jesus Christ, to the Father. And that is being done in every time zone, probably at most of the hours of the day, by some priest somewhere,
yeah.
At least in the 21st century. So that's being done. You have the way the church, the monks, began to pray the Psalms. Well, what did the apostles do? We're told they went up for the prayers in the synagogue, in the temple, the third, the sixth, and the ninth hour. The church has a morning prayer and an evening prayer representing the morning and evening sacrifice. It has a mid-morning prayer, a midday prayer, and a mid-afternoon prayer. So the structure that the church eventually adopted in its own prayer life and liturgical life was preceded and prepared prophetically by the institutions of the old law, reinvigorated by the Sermon on the Mount and the charity of Christ, which comes through his passion, death, and resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite natural that this would be done. And so I think an answer to your question, which I think I already gave, was, yes, you can learn something from it. Don't go there to worship in any real sense. But you can certainly go there and look to see the ways in which the church actually, and Christ at the Last Supper, actually fulfilled the institutions of Israel.
Mary Ann, thanks so much for your call from Cleveland. It is Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan here on EWTN. Let's go to Henry, a first-time caller from San Antonio, listening on the Great Guadalupe Radio. Henry, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. Yeah, my question is, I remember the last time we had all the cardinals show up mm-hmm. to vote and, you know, the conclave. I remember there was an imposter, I believe, that they caught that was dressed like everybody else. And I think he was caught because maybe, I'm not sure if it was because of the belt or because of the rosary where he had it on his waist or something, but it was at a position somewhere. And somebody called him out, and they found out he was an imposter that was trying to make his way into the conclave there to vote. And I was wondering what kind of security they have there to make sure everybody there is officially, you know, like cardinal or something, because yeah. I know there's so many people there, are so many cardinals there.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't consulted on the security, but I am sure that it is very tight. And remember, these are all men. They may, you know, if you're from one side of the world and you've never met the guy from the other side of the world, sure, you've got a problem there. But I think this is probably less of a problem than it's ever been because we're such a highly documented world now.
Yes, yes.
I don't know. Are they asking them for their passports? That might be the most secure way.
You know, it might be.
And you know what? I believe every cardinal has a Vatican passport. I may be mistaken on that.
Okay.
So it might be that is an element of it, or a special ID card. Anyway, I may ask that question of somebody I know who will know the answer, but I don't know it exactly, and that's my surmise in any case.
Best we can do at the moment. Henry, thanks so much for your call from San Antonio. It is Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan here on EWTN. Still time for your phone call. We can squeeze in one or two more at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Let's go to Jordan now in Cincinnati, listening on the Great Sacred Heart Radio, AM 740. Hello, Jordan. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hi. I was just wanting some clarification on the Last Supper being the Passover meal, but then they also talk about, I believe it's in John, how Jesus was sacrificed on the cross at the same time that the lambs were being sacrificed, which I thought that would be for Passover the day before. So I'm just wanting that clarified.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. The lambs certainly were being sacrificed, probably not right up to sundown, because they have to, you know, get on and prepare for when they can no more do no more work. And so it is said, I read this number, my recollection of the number is that because there were obligations on the part of the Jew to go up to Jerusalem for the high holy days, among which was Passover, there might have been 10,000 visitors in Jerusalem. Now, how do you slaughter 10,000 lambs in one day? You don't. It's going on all week. The lamb is roasted and the Passover is celebrated in proximity to the day of Passover, uh-huh. which would begin at sundown on Friday. But the slaughtering goes on. Now, as to the coming together of the of Christ with his disciples for a Passover on the day before, on the Thursday night, it was not unheard of.
Okay.
There is what's called a habara, which means a smaller gathering of people. And very often the rabbis with their disciples would celebrate, the rabbis would celebrate with their disciples on a different day than the actual Passover, because the instructions are that a man and his family and maybe their neighbors are joining in to go. So you're a rabbi, you have disciples, and you want to celebrate the Passover, and so you can't keep people from going. Most of these men are married. Paul was an exception. You know, he said he was an unmarried, but he was, you know, a disciple of Gamaliel. That would have been exceptional, the celibacy in those days. Although later it would be less so. Marrying the Torah became, in some circles, something that could be done. A rabbi spending his life so much on the Torah that he didn't marry. But in those, in the first century, they would have been married. So their rabbi holds the Passover with them the day before, and then they're with their families following the instruction given by Moses to Israel when they were in Egypt. And that's likely what took place, that this was a fellowship Sabbath, if you will, this small gathering that anticipated the Passover. And finally, what the only other thing we have to draw on is this is the Son of God. He wants to hold the Passover the day before to prefigure his own, you know, passion, death, and resurrection, to begin on the night he would go to the garden to be arrested and his passion would begin, then God has provided that.
Yeah.
But I think you're also looking for the historical background, and I think this fellowship meal that rabbis would hold in anticipation of the Passover is that, potentially at least, that background.
All right, Jordan, thanks so much for your call from Cincinnati. We hope that is helpful for you. It is Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan here on EWTN. Coming up next on most of these EWTN radio stations, it's Beacon of Truth with Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers. On today's program, they'll be unpacking Psalm 83, verses 10 through 13. That'll be on the Soulful Psalm segment. Also, the explosion of overseas vocations. That's coming up next on most of these EWTN stations at 3 p.m. Eastern. Now, I have heard about the explosion of people coming into the church, notably in France mm-hmm. and some other countries, but I've not heard about an explosion of vocations. Have you?
No, but I do. I do remember reading, and there's been a couple Pew Research studies with the last number of classes of ordinands to the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
What their predominant influences of, and there is a definite trending to both great piety and great orthodoxy. Now, whether it's in quantitatively it's explosive, I don't know the answer to that. I think it's very situational. I think the record shows that where where the bishop has led the way in those elements.
Uh-huh.
That reinforces the historical tradition of the church and the historical practices of the church. And I'm not speaking traditional Latin Mass necessarily,
right.
But simply that fidelity, piety, and orthodoxy go together.
Sure.
And especially the practices that were in the past common, like Marian devotion and so on, and Eucharistic devotion, which you know, practically any spiritual author in the life of the church would have said, you know, the Eucharist, the Mary, and the devotion to the Pope, whoever he is, mm-hmm. these are three pillars of the Catholic life. You know, the Pope unites us in unity, the yep. sacraments unite us in hope, and then of course the faith of the church is the doctrine is what unites us in the way we think and the way our mind is formed
sure.
and our will chooses from that.
Yep.
So those elements are quite reasonable and logical. I think it's certainly a phenomena to watch. They've been saying this for maybe a decade now. I certainly believe that that mother's role had a great deal to reverse it.
Yes.
The trends, Pope John Paul II, Benedict. And I think even Francis, there have been reports of conversions. I think many people are drawn to his merciful style. You know, in the church, we're like any family, we fight about this, that, and the other thing. But I think a lot of people saw the way he acted towards the poor and the marginalized.
Yes.
And for them, this was very inspirational. This
yeah.
is what, you know, Christ called us to do. Now, the reality of day-to-day church life is you have to unite the truth with the faith and with love. And so that's always an ongoing project, and no one ever gets it perfectly, you know. And so that will continue with the next pope and until the second coming.
We have I guess you could call him an honorary godson, who is a seminarian right now. He's at St. Meinrad. He is in the process of eventually becoming a military chaplain. And he says that in that archdiocese of the military service, there's been a lot of new young guys coming in, and that's really good news for those people in the pipeline, because there's a real shortage of Catholic chaplains in the military right now.
There always has been, even when I was in the Navy. And was asked to be a lay leader on my ship, a small ship, and you're uh-huh. not, you know, on carriers, large ships, a cruiser, you might have a chaplain. He might mm-hmm. be Catholic or not, but certainly on a carrier, you'd have a Catholic chaplain, a Protestant chaplain.
Yeah.
But a little ship, you don't, so asked to be a lay leader. Yeah, it was very mm-hmm. difficult, you know, during the end of the period of the Vietnam War, and so they were, at that time, there wasn't per se a military archdiocese. But it was in those days, it was convincing men ordained for dioceses to come and serve in the military. So I think the institution of the military ordinariate has certainly probably helped.
Yeah.
But they still have to do the encouraging of vocations. And I believe the rules also require that they serve pastoral practice in an existing other diocese
yeah.
before they actually begin their service.
I believe
in
for
the military
three years.
Three
I
years.
Think.
That's been the truth.
Very good.
Yeah.
All right. It's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan. We have time for another call. Here is Alex, a first-time caller from Dallas, listening on the Great Guadalupe Radio, AM 910. Hello, Alex. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, folks. Thank you. I remember in 2003, a very close friend of mine, a priest, recommended me to read about a certain cardinal called Joseph Ratzinger, anything that came out of his mouth, right? And I did. And, you know, I have paid more attention to Pope Benedict, drawing deeply from his homilies and writings.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, firstly, to be honest, I want to thank you for the rosary this week after Daily Mass in EWTN, because I stayed for the rosary, and you guys read a lot of meditations and homilies from Pope Francis that really, really deeply touched me. I want to commit myself to, you know, praying with and reading a lot more about Pope Francis intentionally. But I would really love to hear your perspective. How do you personally approach the spiritual writings and meditations for both popes? Very different, mm-hmm. but I think, again, Benedict is extremely obvious and it's
sure,
face yeah. value, right? But Pope Francis, a lot more humble and a Jesuit and a Latin American person. But the readings and the homilies that you guys selected were incredibly deep.
Yeah.
Incredibly deep.
Yeah. You know, every pope is different. I'm doing the count the other day. I was to see like six or seven popes that I've lived under, going back to Pius the 12th. I remember the later ones. I remember Paul the 6th because of Humanae Vitae.
Yes.
And being in college and trying to explain contraception to classmates, and I'd never read the document. I said, well, I better go read the document.
Yeah.
And in reading, I said, this is truth. And that began my journey in theology. Mm-hmm. John Paul the 1st, you know, there were some of his little sayings and things that he had written that got published, but unfortunately he was only with us for, I think, 28 days.
Yeah.
John Paul II was really my guy because I wrote on him at the Angelicum. So, you know, it is quite clear that philosophically and theologically his contribution to the church is enormous, and we're actually probably going to do a good deal on that here's future in the Catholic sphere, talking about the relationship of those kinds of things to the troubles in modern thinking.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to unite all areas, elements of truth. Benedict, central on Christ and the role of Christ, his books on Jesus Christ, his homilies, his catechesis, very much the intellectual, but very much able to explain lucidly why the church believes and what it believes. And Francis is a little bit more different. His pastoral style in Argentina was to go into the barrios and to meet the people and to talk to them and to build a friendship with the what now 80-year-old woman who sold newspapers on the corner and all of these kinds of things. Well, that she's gone now for that matter. But in any case, this kind of personal things. He wasn't the academic, and sometimes he could be very imprecise in his theology, and that would get corrected later on by somebody in the whole, well, the Pope really meant this, and of course that is true, and, you know. So I think his exhortations, and it's interesting, Alex, that you mentioned that, those things which exhort us to the charity of Christ and to imitate that and to holiness, those are probably his better writings. And I think the effort was made, no doubt, I wasn't involved in what was chosen by the friars for those prayers and rosaries and so on. But I would think that those were, you know, something central to his pontificate, but also among the best things that he did. And these are the things people found very challenging. You know, if he said, why do we put people to death through capital punishment? That'd be a challenge to people who ask, well, why should somebody who kills 10 people or whatever, you go free? Those challenge us to think about the dignity of man and the mm-hmm. life of man and how man is to be treated, even recognizing the sin of man, the great, great sin of man. But these exhortations are something for us to think about and pray about and to apply them in our lives such as we can, realizing that in most of those exhortations to charity and to doing, you know, great things for others also depend on our personal capacity, moral, material, and otherwise, and we may not be able to live up to them any more than we can live up to the Gospels. But I think it's always good that the church has those, and I'm very grateful, Alex, that you found them so useful in your own journey.
Alex, thank you so much for your call from Dallas this afternoon. I read somewhere this week, and I had never really thought of it before reading this, and maybe it was a conjecture, I'm not sure, but someone said that Bergoglio chose the name Francis because of his great love of the poor. Had you heard that?
Yes, that's generally the account of it,
is
that Francis was the one, and he mingled with everybody. He touched the lepers when nobody else would, and so on.
He didn't make that statement at the time, though. He just said, this is the name, I'm choosing it. He didn't say, this is why I'm choosing it, right?
No, that usually comes out later, you know, okay. When Benedict, with his Benedict, why did Ratzinger choose Benedict?
Yeah.
The elements of the shield and the motto and all of those things. We usually get the details on that and the... what those different elements mean after the fact, and I think that that's certainly the case in Francis as it was for his predecessors.
Very good. Colin Donovan, thank you, my friend, and have a wonderful weekend.
You as well.
Hope everybody has a wonderful weekend. Don't forget our solemn funeral mass broadcast for His Holiness. That'll be at 3 a.m. live on EWTN Radio and TV, 3 a.m. Eastern Time, with an encore at 10 a.m. on both radio and TV, and then again at 6 p.m. on EWTN Television and our other radio service, or one of them, EWTN Radio Extra. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Colin Donovan. We hope you have that great weekend, and we will see you next week. God bless.